The point is that I think at the core of it is like, as marketing and salespeople, we have to have empathy for like our buyers. And when we have that, we think about how they would respond to what we're doing to them. And that kind of like shocks us out of like this marketing and sales, like best practices mindset that everyone is so caught up in.
You're absolutely right. The moment when we sat down, because apparently we can't do things the traditional way, because that's what I put out there. We're not traditional sales training. Mm-hmm. We're not for everyone, right? If you want to continue cold calling, fine, but don't ask me for a sales script for cold calling or for outbound a little bit. If done correctly, we have a framework how you can do it. So you go from cold calling or cold outreach to warm and hot prospecting.
Interesting.
But the thing is, the moment I just sat down and said, okay, how do we draft a message in our outreach that is non-intrusive, but sparks that first trigger of a conversation, or at least a response? Because a no response is better than no response. I love no's. Just give me if we're not for you, if that is if this is the wrong timing or whatever, just give me a no. That's fine. So I know that they read that puts us in the back of their minds and blah 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 blah. You know, it's like
you've been seen.
And so I have the feeling at the moment, the vast majority of sales and marketing, especially sales, they're using the same playbook. I don't know where the hell they are getting it from, but it's always the same playbook. It's like, hello, XYZ. I noticed that you went to university XYZ. Great LinkedIn post. We help companies like yours achieve 50% more revenue.
Yeah.
Wanna hop on a call? Thank you. And then you'll be put in sequences.
Mm-hmm.
Unsolicitedly. Yeah. Why are you put? I mean, I have a very strong opinion about LinkedIn. If you're on LinkedIn and you accept my invite, you're open for business. We can talk.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Yep, that's fair.
I'm not pitching you, but I'm asking you, are you thinking about this or that?
Mm-hmm.
It's just one simple question. So we don't get intrusive, but we can spark that initial conversation, which is good, which helps. And it works. We have the data to back it up. But if you, it's the same playbook from the 80s and 90s and noughties, and all of a sudden, or let's just, you know, slap it on LinkedIn. Great.
Of course,
if you have an open profile on LinkedIn, you get the phone number, you get the personal email, more than the professional, because everybody signs up with their Gmail or iCloud or whatever it is. But that is not a permission to put someone in a sequence.
I think about it if I was at a party or like a networking event and there were a bunch of, you know, CMOs, CROs, like founders, VCs, because those are the people I sell to. And I was to have a drink in my hand and they had a drink in their hand and we happened to start talking. How much would I really want to pitch them in that first minute? Like, I don't want to pitch them at all. I just want to connect with them and find out maybe a little bit about their life, like what they're, you know, what's their struggles they're dealing with, like what's interesting in their industry. Do you know what I mean? Like, and so when I think about like first touch points with prospects, like they're still people. Like, I don't want to be awkward and salesy and pitchy in that first like 5 minutes. And that's kind of what you're saying. Like that first like outreach, just be human. Like,
but it's impossible, especially for SDRs who mostly are still under sales for prospecting.
Totally.
And not under marketing. That's what they do. They get into a pan because, you know, it is like from the management point of view, that's the KPIs. That's the numbers that they have to bring, which is completely insane. It's more management at the moment mostly focuses on output instead of outcome.
Yeah.
And with our sales team, if they have one conversation in a week, but they close that because the likelihood that they close it is better because we pre-qualify the shit out of every prospect, then I'm fine, because your job is sales. It's not prospecting. Yeah. Your job is sales. Be here comes the hate words, trusted advisor, right?
It's not wrong though.
I always
it's just overused.
it is overused, but that's how you can position yourself in such a strong way. If you detach yourself from the outcome and from your own product, mm-hmm. and say, okay, you're struggling with an LMS. What is it that you want to do? Mm-hmm. You want to be able to sell like the access to the school instead of in individual courses. Have you looked at this or that? Mm-hmm. Instead of saying we do exactly that.
Yeah.
Can I like book a meeting with you? I know where they're coming from. I know that's a desperation and a mm-hmm. panic mm-hmm. because everybody needs to hit their numbers, which is absolutely, it's not ridiculous, but it's old school. It's very old school. If you detach yourself from that, and just a couple of weeks ago, we made a decision to put everything published on the website, from the pricing to mm-hmm. the how we work with you. This is our commitment. This is what we bring to the table, but this is also what we expect you to do. Mm-hmm. Please ask yourself a couple of questions before you get in touch with us.
I love that.
Yeah. Here's the price. Yeah. And it's a ridiculously high price because mm-hmm. we want to work with people who and businesses who are committed. Mm-hmm. We don't do one-offs. We stay with the customer, with the business for at least 3 months. And mm-hmm. that is what it costs. Mm-hmm. We don't do one-offs because we know after 90 days, max, they forget all of that. If we're not mm-hmm. there for them every yep. week, at least virtually, they fall back into old behavior, old habits.
I believe
and it. It's fine. That's human nature. You know, we just want to be there once they make the decision to do the transformation, mm-hmm. to be there and really ensure that success that they mm-hmm. have.
That's so interesting.
And one thing that I said when we discussed this is because we had a lot of less qualified calls.
Right.
And no shows.
Yeah.
So we know how to avoid that. But yep. still, it happens. You know, it happens. If the buyer can't qualify themselves, and I love what you wrote.
Yeah.
Everything they need to either qualify themselves or disqualify yeah. themselves.
Yeah.
We're out yep. of a budget, and we're out of a budget from probably any startup, maybe it's Series B, Series C. That's where it starts, or self-sufficient yeah. cash flow piece.
Yeah. Same for me, actually.
And disqualify. And I told everyone, it's like, I'd rather have just, you know, just a portion of the meetings booked than we used to in the past.
100%.
We
yeah.
know now they're interested. They have everything that they need mm-hmm. to make a decision about us as a vendor to initiate the conversation. I'd rather have that conversation.
Yeah.
Because the likelihood that we close them is higher because apparently they understand where we are coming from mm-hmm. already. And then they make mm-hmm. a decision. Okay, mm-hmm. let's see, what is this unconventional sales training? What are they up to?
Yeah.
And so I think that is the positioning is also so important. Positioning, branding, marketing, promoting, getting your stuff out there in front mm-hmm. of the right people. Mm-hmm. I agree with you that this would be the marketing part of it. And sales should be there to say, okay, what are your challenges? Let's see if we are right fit for you. Mm-hmm. If not, I might have some different ideas, right? Yeah. And that is basically qualifying on both sides, on both ends. You know, you just
yep. so totally
feel that you're qualifying them, but it, in fact, it is. So let's have a conversation to see if we're a good fit for us and we're a good fit for you. And
exactly.
then I'm happy if that's a match, let's go.
Yeah. 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 I think one of the things that shocks me often about salespeople I talk to with my clients is like how little they know about the other options in the market that buyers are facing. And like kind of in your LMS example, like
yeah.
if they had a better idea of the landscape or like other options you might be considering, they might realize that it's really hard for you to differentiate. Like that was that key part for you. It's so hard to differentiate. And so then they might figure out, oh, like we need to play up something unique about us, or we need to invent something like if we don't have anything. But I don't mean the salesperson invents it, but do you know what I mean? Like if they were aware of, like if they had put themselves in your shoes and looked at the market and be like, oh man, this is really hard to choose. How are people doing it? Like then they get that bit of like that spark of empathy and they're like, okay, what can we do to make it easier for them to buy?
I absolutely love it. It's not only the LMS sector. I feel that
sure.
as soon as you go into SaaS or technology, that's like a homogenous sea of options.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself that sales in these sectors, as it has been done traditionally, has more to do with luck than anything.
Interesting.
You'll be lucky if someone finds you, if someone finds you attractive, if someone finds you attractive who has the budget, who has the need, and has the right timing to get in touch with you. Otherwise, you're out. And maybe if I don't know, if the potential buyer had a good night's sleep.
That's terrible. Hey. We can't leave so many things to change.
Yeah, but there is, isn't there?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, if we talk about like the business conditions that exist in a business just happen to, you know, coalesce in this particular point, I guess that is chance. And then the salesperson finds you at that point. I would add that to it. But yeah.
and then everything else. And then you have, once you're in the funnel, in that vendor universe, and you're, as a buyer, you're not only in one. So you're right. Evaluating.
Exactly.
I talked to three, maybe four, five vendors at the same time, or you put out tenders, you know, and let them come to you. That's even easier if you're a large company, you just put out tenders. It's like every salesperson or every sales organization has that panic and that pressure to whoever enters the funnel, they need to close.
Yeah.
And so we talk about that from what you send me through the agenda, because I really
that's
my free trial. Can I have a look at the software at least?
Yeah.
What's your pricing? Well, talk to sales. I don't want to talk to sales. Show me the damn software, or I go to YouTube and Google it, or to
my colleagues in the industry. Like I get that a lot. Like when I ask buyers who they're. Like how they kind of, you know, supported themselves in making a decision. They're like, oh, well, we talked to all of our colleagues. We figured out like who, you know, within the States is using it. Like we talked to a bunch of different, you know, users already. And like the company is sometimes oblivious of this. And that's one of my recommendations often for clients is like, if you know that people are already soliciting the feedback of other users and their colleagues, and they're finding out like if there's, you know, bad things to know about your software, why don't you just have a list of people they can call, and not a marketing list, but actually just a list like of good, of people who like it and people who are kind of, you know, tepid maybe, because they will be finding someone's opinion. Yeah, and like the easier you can make that for them, like the faster the sale will go.
Yeah, absolutely. And the peer trust is way higher than the vendor trust.
Exactly. That's the whole thing. Yeah, exactly. Like the more you can, you know, even give like a very balanced opinion of your software through the mouths of your customers. Like, it's so invaluable.
Yeah, because every solution has its ups and downs.
Exactly.
There are positives and negatives. And you mentioned that, and I look forward to discussing that, like with the comparison table. And every vendor, please forgive me, dear vendors, but it's bullshitting its way through these comparison tables to make them look the best. And that feature, we all know that a CRM or an LMS or a video conference, there are some ups and downs. So just be honest, be upfront with the downs. What is it?
Yeah.
We're enterprise pricing. We're not startup. Okay, so thank you. And that's it. So I'll look for something in the startup pricing that's more catered to what I need and stuff like that. And I love reviews because unless they're bought. So
true. Yeah.
And you can scroll through the positives and the negatives. And it's important to hear the negatives and then just balance it. Is that something that we can work with?
Exactly. You know? Yeah.
Or is it something that won't integrate with what we already have or what is it actually that we need to, and then jumping through the hoops until at the end you can talk to sales, that's just a wasted time up until that point, you know,
And buyers are so like, when they're in that active research mode, they just want to get as much as they can as quickly as they can. And like, we're all like that. Like, we have the internet. Like, that's how we use it. Like, when we need information, we go hunting.
Yeah.
Not a surprise.
The bar is so ridiculously low. Mm-hmm. It's so ridiculously low. Yeah. What do I need? From a consumer point of view, I look at product, product image, product district, mm-hmm. description, price, reviews. Maybe if there's a free trial, I'll just download the app and try it, and then I'll decide if I pay for it. Mm-hmm. Disclosure, I never pay for apps on my phone because I think that's just ridiculous. The pricing the pricing model is just ridiculous. Anyway, but that's like a handful.
Yeah.
For B2C. Yeah. And for B2B, that is the lowest of any entry bar mm-hmm. that you can imagine. Mm-hmm. How does it work? What does it cost? How long is it for me to implement? What do others say about you?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's true. I know. I mean, I'm excited that there's lots of opportunity to improve B2B businesses.
Yeah.
Like, this is a good time because this hopefully will be solved in like 25 to 30 years, but we'll see.
Well, I think, well, the good thing is that there are a lot of B2B companies are waking up to that. And through the work that you do on the marketing side, and hopefully that's what I hope from our side, what we do for sales side, we can make it easier for buyers to buy from a vendor.
Yeah.
By enabling the people on the sales side and the marketing side of the vendor to really just work together with the buyer. And just make it ridiculously easy and simple mm-hmm. to get all the information they need. And again, it's just a handful, right? Initially, of course, then it goes on and on and on. If you're going into corporate, you have 8, 12, 15 decision makers and everybody thinks they have a say in it. And then stuff like that happens. But that's also something that you can control, even if you're not in the room. That's part of the probing sales framework that we developed. So just all these little bits and pieces just work together beautifully if sales and marketing would just listen to the buyer, you know?
Amen.
Sarah, shall we start? We already started.
Sure.
I mean, it's
sure.
We don't have like an official kind of intro or stuff like that. Put everything in the description so that people know who you are, that you're absolutely passionate about buyer-centric and buyer-enabling content on the marketing side of things. And we came together here to discuss what we call the four things that B2B buyers, especially SaaS buyers, hate about sales. And we can expand on that and say, what do they hate about sales? What do they hate about marketing and the purchasing process in general? What are the hurdles for them and the hoops to jump through to actually get rid of their money? and so kind of, we were thinking about, why is it so damn complicated? Why isn't it as easy as going on Amazon? Where's the Amazon in B2B spaces? There is none. For several reasons. Sometimes the reason is fear of competition, fear of too much transparency. But there's also lack of knowledge, lack of knowing there are alternative options. There are things that you can do differently without losing market share, without losing your position in the market, without losing revenue. On the contrary, when you do things differently, you might get better and different results. So that's where we both are positioned, you on the marketing side, me on the sales side. And we discussed a little bit beforehand before this podcast, and we came down with kind of four topics that we would like to discuss and have a conversation about. And let's just dig and dive right into that. The first thing that you said to me is that buyers hate getting slowed down by sales, specifically SDRs and the discovery and qualifying calls, because they offer very little value for the buyer. So discovery calls offer value for the vendor, for sales, but not to the buyer. Why is it that sales still have these discovery calls? And what could we do differently in combination with marketing to help the buyer maybe avoid that, these discovery calls? qualify themselves and also maybe disqualify themselves faster and even before sales is in the picture at all. Because that's also a lot of wasted time and resources for sales to talk to someone who is not really a good fit. So we have to be a little bit selfish and egotistical in sales to see if a prospect might be a good fit. So I just over to you, actually, Sarah. How do you feel we can solve these things in terms of discovery calls? How can we solve that with content and marketing?
I think that the big question is really like, who is qualifying who? And a lot of times, when we're on a sales or marketing team, as the vendor, we feel like it's the most maximum efficiency route for us to qualify prospects as quickly as we can and then send them on their way if they're not going to be a good fit for us. And that is true. But the issue is that, well, not the issue, I guess the reality is that we are dealing with people who, in fact, are going through their own purchasing process. And we feel like they're in our funnel, but I think we're actually in their funnel. So the way I see it is that we, as a buyer, they are, disqualifying vendors as they gain more information that helps them understand if they're going to be a good fit for their needs. So things that are really important usually are pricing. What does the product look like? How can I experience it through a demo? And so we know that SDR calls are often a step that happens before, not in all cases, but in a lot of cases, before buyers get pricing or a demo. And from talking to, tons of B2B SaaS buyers, what they tell me is that, they have different feelings about the SDR call. Some of them don't even know why they're being put into a call with what is apparently a very junior person when they have a very big business need. And this person asks them questions and they don't really understand, like, it feels like a bait and switch. Like they're waiting really to get their teeth into the pricing and the demo that they know they'll get from sales. But they end up wasting time with this SDR. And even worse, if it's taken a long time to book a meeting with this person through email tag or whatever, chasing. But yeah, like others, attend the SDR call, but they feel like the way that it's run is actually serving the vendor more than serving them. And so to your point about, how can we use marketing and content to improve the way this goes? I think, well, first we have to think about how the buyer feels at this point. Like they are in a research process. They are trying to, extract as much information from vendors as they can to make a good decision. And they're looking at multiple vendors. And so what I have recommended to some of my clients that has worked really well is to use this touch point with the SDRs as a way to actually help buyers build requirements. Because we know from Gartner, that's one of the key buying jobs they have to accomplish in themselves. And some of them will come to the SDR call and they'll have a few ideas about requirements, but like really who is a better partner than the vendor to help them work through that process? Like they should know all the features, they should know all the customer needs, and they can ask good questions. Like as a vendor, you're positioned to ask good questions that helps the buyer better understand what their needs are. And so in the cases of the clients that I've worked with, like what they've done is use that as a form that they send to the clients, to the buyers afterwards. And that becomes a tool that they use in the rest of their buying journey. Like whether they're going to other vendors, whether they come back to you, now they have a record of these things that they need. And it's super useful, like especially in these cases where we have B2B SaaS with like a million features and a million different like little nuances that you could, choose this, choose that, like add this package, add that package. So that's something that we've tried and it's worked, which makes me happy because I know that it helps buyers, but I also know that it can be a bit of a mindset switch for a sales team to think that, we're going to help people with something and they may not come back to us. So that's kind of like the shift you have to make in your mind.
That's a really great point. They might not come back. A lot of it has to do with the panic of hitting your targets and the fear of inactivity, the fear of just sitting there and not having prospects come into the funnel and leads come into the funnel. But I really love what you say that it would increase the productivity and then, of course, the ROI of an individual sales rep or the sales team in general. If buyers would disqualify themselves earlier without even having to talk to sales, because most of the time, what we see on the sales side is that we talk to buyers who are not a good fit for us. So it's important for us, of course, to qualify fast and disqualify faster. But the mindset shift that you mentioned is really, is that necessary, or can we just move the whole disqualification way earlier in the process and then have fewer conversations, but more meaningful conversations that lead to a better conversion rate and a better closing rate, because the buyer knows a lot about us before we even pick up the phone. So that's the thing that we are working on, to eliminate all these things, move that out of the way for sales, to have absolutely spot on conversations without, you know, sounding like Columbo and you know, interrogating buyer, yeah. You know?
Yeah.
So marketing and especially content can help in that case to provide the buyer with the information they need to evaluate us as a vendor, if I understand you correctly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think like it's a mix of really strong positioning, where you get really clear if you're, and not every business is focused really clearly on a niche of customers, but I always think that's the strongest business strategy. And if that's the case for you, like for instance, you're doing, you know, sales transformation for B2B SaaS companies, I think. Is that correct? Okay. Maybe it's even more specific than that. I think it is more specific than that even. If that is your specific niche, then, you know, put it somewhere on your site so people recognize themselves when they see that. And like, so that's the positioning side of things. And there's also like the side of, you know, there's just obvious pieces of information that they need. Like, I think, you know, we talked about pricing before. Pricing is really important. Like, it's just important. And people disqualify themselves very easily. And you're in that process, eliminating a bunch of conversations that you don't have to have because people don't have money to work with you. And it's just as simple as that. Like, do you want your sales time wasting time having conversations with people who don't have budget? No. Like, so I am a fan of being as transparent as possible in both, you know, those like your niche and also those specific pieces of buying information that are so critical to understanding if, you know, a prospect is going to be a good fit for you.
This gating all of that pieces of information that is crucial for the buyer to make a decision in their evaluation phase. If I don't see everything all at once within two or three clicks, I'm getting bored out of my head. Mm-hmm. It's whenever I see on the pricing page of a SaaS company, you have in the menu, you have pricing. And that's always like, great, that's where I expect it to be. And then you, the first thing you see after you click that is a contact form. And so, hold on a second. I wanted to see the pricing, not get in touch with sales.
Yeah.
If the pricing is a fit to my budget, then I might consider you and go along the way. But from the sales side, from the vendor side, there's a lot of things that go into the decision to keep the pricing obscured. And that can be, we're in an oversaturated market. We're a commodity. The solution is rather a commodity. So we don't want the competitors to know where we are, where we position ourselves. Could be that it's an enterprise target market. So pricing might start at 1500 per month. I don't know, just, you know, out of the blue.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's not for startups, but you know, isn't it important enough to just put that out there? And whenever we go and talk to a customer that don't do that, we make a few suggestions to either put the pricing out there, either it's a tiered pricing, and just work on the positioning. If mm-hmm. if you are not afraid of any competitor, then you just put it out there. Mm-hmm. And I think it is so much clearer in terms of positioning when you know, as a visitor or as a buyer to the website, okay, that is the budget. If I want to go with that, I like what I see so far. So now I can budget that maybe for next quarter, but maybe even for next year. I don't know, but you know, dependent on many factors. Mm-hmm. And I think that helps a lot. And that would also eliminate a lot of wasted time for sales, and then increase the ROI of each individual sales rep, increase the productivity tremendously, mm-hmm. also increase the KPIs, of course, and so forth. And also, if you think about it, when we talk about enterprise sales, sometimes if you are too cheap or if the pricing is too low, you might not even be considered serious as a serious vendor, right? Mm-hmm. So you might say, okay, there's a tender for a website. We can do a website for 25K. We're a startup. We need the money. We need the contracts. Let's put in 25K. And then you have an established developer or marketing agency that put in 250,000 and they get, mm-hmm. they get the yes, because the buyer says, well, 25K, they can't be serious. But for the business, for the startup, it might be the biggest client they've ever gotten. So that's also positioning, as you just said, it has to, it goes into branding and positioning, sales and marketing. So I really like where you are coming from and have that eye on the positioning as well, and everything that the buyer finds about you to make a sophisticated decision. That's also part of the positioning. That's part of the branding. Yes. Part of how buyers perceive a vendor. So I really like that point that you raised. Fab, we know that helping the buyer to qualify us as a vendor, and I think we need to, especially sales, we want to get out of this arrogance to say our product is the best and we need to close. No, we need to give the buyer everything that they need to make a decision. So it makes it easier for us as well to have a conversation with someone who pre-qualified themselves or disqualified themselves.
Very much so.
Yeah. From your work, what have you seen as an accelerator, as a speed accelerator that sales and marketing, and especially the content side, can do to really help speeding up the sales cycle and speed up the buy cycle? What are some things that you can share with us, what marketing can do?
Yeah, particularly around like the point of when they're looking at demo kind of thing. Yeah. So, I mean, one really easy thing, and again, like similar to pricing, there's a lot of questions around whether or not this is a good choice regarding fear of competitors, but is just to ungate your demo. And so I talk to a lot of buyers who, like I mentioned when we were chatting before, like before they've even seen a demo, they've already done a round of conversations with their, you know, colleagues at other companies or people they know in the industry who have used this tool. And so some of them come to the demo having already seen or already talked about the tool, maybe in some cases have seen it if they've done like a screen share with their colleague. And so like, if you think you're hiding something by gating it, like, I don't know, people can find this information and they will, right? Like when they're serious, and particularly when, you know, these decisions are like a very high price tag and either, you know, there's obviously perceptions of their success at work that are attached to the decision. Like there's so much riding on this. So I think ungating the demo can be a great thing to do. I think another thing is I've seen actually some different types of software. Omadime is one of them. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but that allow you to take videos of your demo and break it up into points based on keywords. And so like A, it's ungated, B, it's searchable. And so you can, you know, if you have a buyer coming and they have a specific need around a specific feature for whatever their use case is, you can enable them to actually like go to that specific part of the software. And then they immediately know, they can immediately answer that question. Is this what I need? Is this not what I need? You know, can I disqualify myself out of this funnel like we were saying before? So I think there's a few creative things you can do with your demo. And I mean, the other part of it is pricing. Like when sales is the gatekeeper of pricing, like we talked about before, that like it just slows people down. So
yeah. I like the kind of the ungated demo that you can record and you have keywords, and that's absolutely amazing. Mm-hmm. How important would you say for your customers is the shareability? I don't even know if that's an English word. The ability to share content, pricing, demos, videos, maybe. How important is that for your customers to speeding up to accelerate the sales cycle? What does that do to sales?
So the shareability of demos with respect to like with their colleagues or with other people who might be buying?
Exactly, with the decision-making committee. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of is like what I was talking about, them having conversations with people in the industry, like they're sharing things already. Like they're talking about pricing. They're asking questions like, well, is that really worth it? Like, it just seems so expensive. Like, and should I go for that extra package? Like, I'm just not sure if it is worth, you know, that extra tier for the extra features. So I think I would say like the simpler you can make all that stuff, like the accessibility of it, so people can share it with each other, but also like, you know, how easy is it to understand your pricing models or your tiers and stuff, knowing that other people will be trying to explain it to your buyers when they go looking for information beyond you that isn't, you know, in a sales and marketing tone.
Oh,
yeah. I think shareability is important, but the key to it is really clarity. Like, how clear is your messaging? You know, how accessible is your marketing information, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you a story about one vendor that was last year. I'm not going to say names. I'm not going to say the industry, but it was a big player. And they had on their website a button very, you know, present in the menu and multiple times throughout the website.
Mm-hmm.
Start your free trial here,
mm-hmm.
which I thought, right, let's go for it.
Yeah.
I think it was 7 days or 14 days, and it was just
okay.
Fairly basic. And so what happened was, number one, I did not get my free trial. Number two, I was almost forced to book a call. And number two, since then, I regularly get phone calls and emails.
Yeah.
And I still have
that chased.
My free trial. Wow. So here's the thing. I think we are all buyers in whatever capacity. We buy for our business, we buy for ourselves. So we are in that B2B space, especially when you're an entrepreneur. So we know how absolutely frustrating it can be to be chased. And there's another thing that I despise about the traditional or the sales traditionalists is that war language and that hunting language. And let's go hunt for some leads and say, really?
Yeah,
where we are right now.
Agreed.
So if you promise something like a free trial, just stick to your word, you know, let your actions equal your words. And I think that is, I see that also a lot from our customers who are also buyers at some point in time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they buy from us as a vendor, for example, that they get absolutely frustrated with too many touch points, right?
Yes.
Do I really want to put my email and my contact details on that website? Because I'm absolutely certain I will get inundated with some emails, yeah, some phone calls, or some ludicrous automated sequence and so forth. So I think that is a topic of security, cybersecurity, and privacy as well. Mm-hmm. that we need to discuss. And as much as I agree with your, and I fully support that as well, big advocate of transparency,
mm-hmm.
we need to transform the mindset in the background. Just because someone gives you their email address or maybe even phone number does not mean they are fair game to you. So you have to, that's the ethical standard here in the background.
Yeah. Yeah,
and that I think is the panic that you talked about, that we might lose leads out of the funnel if we ungate everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
you will lose.
Yeah,
it's good. But the ones that are not immediately ready to have conversations, and like, it's just doing more work for you. Like, it's just making it more efficient for you to work with the buyers who are ready to have conversations.
Yeah. How much, just out of interest from your experience, how much, and that might be a general question, and I don't know how you answer it, but I'm going to ask you anyway, because I'm curious. How much time do you think a sales organization could save when you come in with content and the marketing mm-hmm. things to support actually sales, to support the sales organization as well with the strategy based in content and marketing? How much or increase in productivity? How would you measure that?
I would love to measure an increase in productivity. I haven't done that with my clients just because they are in different industries, and I don't think the aggregate of their results would really be worth much. But I do, what I tend to hear from buyers that I've worked with. And it's the content, but it's also the research that, you know, we've done, trying to understand the different steps of the buying process from the client side, all that stuff. What I hear is that they get buyers, anecdotally, buyers are coming to them more informed about their problem, closer to understanding, you know, the nuances of the solution. And in some cases, like there's specific steps of the buying process that used to be a huge hurdle, and now they are so much easier. And I can give you an example of that. Like, so one of my clients, they have a solution that includes an accounting and finance component. And that is like typically so, it just instills panic in everyone in the organization, because accountants, I think I can say this, I have a sister who's an accountant, they don't tend to love a whole lot of change. And when, you know, there's a new system coming in that will change the numbers they're getting in a very simple way, it instills a lot of panic. And so for my client, this was instilling a lot of panic for their buyers, and the accounting transition, they weren't really managing it properly. But one time that had worked for them was when they had matched up a CFO of a buyer, of a previous buyer, with the CFO of a prospective buyer. And they had a conversation. One conversation covered all the, like, you know, icky areas that might be a bit challenging. And the sale just moved forward like a dream. And so what we did from there is we created a content guide for CFOs, really super detailed and technical, like written with the help of, you know, accounting people to review it, to make sure that this was something that would be useful for accountants, because that's something we have to be careful about in marketing. Like, we don't want to, you know, give information sometimes that's like diluted to the point that we're eroding trust in the people who are reading it. So this was just a solid piece of content around the accounting transition. And since they've had that in place, it has changed the way that that part of the sale goes. And there's less panic. There's not no panic. I can't say that. But that's one example of, like, you know, the hurdles that you can get through with. It's not just content, like, it's subject matter expertise, but it works together. And yeah. Does that answer your question?
Absolutely. Yeah. I love it. My follow-up question would be, how did they convince the first CFO? Because you got to start somewhere. So
yeah,
some CFO would have been the first one to say, okay, let's go for it. But I can, you know, you're absolutely right about accountants. Nothing against accountants.
No, I love accountants.
Yeah, my partner's son is 18 and looking to get into accounting. I tried everything. He still wants to do it. But anyway.
It's so handy to have one in the family. I can say that with certainty.
There you go. There was one thing that really stood out when you told that story. And that is something that we find as well as part of what we do on the sales side, is that most buyers have a solution internally that works. Might not work perfectly, might not work as they want it to be, but they have a solution. Everybody has a solution for their problems. So you can start with Excel spreadsheets before you even consider a CRM. So whatever is there in the company, in the organization, and that amplifies as soon as more than one department is attached to that solution. But the biggest competitor, that's what we always say, your biggest competitor is what is already there in the company.
Totally. 100%.
And it's so hard, because the change threshold, especially when you go into corporate, when you have more than one user, more than 10 users, more than one department plugging into a solution, is so high that maybe that's a sale once in a decade sometimes. Yeah. Yeah. But that's what you're up against, right? So I think the point of content marketing then can also be in terms of demand generation and lead generation, not only lead generation, but focus on demand generation. What is out there, well, what we have can help you and support you much more than what you're already doing. But that hurdle, that is there, no matter what, yep. No matter what. So a startup uses kind of pen and paper, Excel spreadsheets, Google Drive, Notion, or whatever is out there. And then they decide at one point, I think we need a little bit more structure. Let's look at CRMs. So what is there? A whole plethora of CRMs. Just waiting for that startup to get to that hockey stick and be ready for sales.
Yeah.
To cold call them.
Yeah.
What would you say about peer trust and also as opposed to trust in the vendor. How do buyers make the decision from your point of view? What do they trust? Where do they go to? Where do they research what they need to make a decision?
Yeah. When you ask buyers, you know, I sometimes ask them, like, have you looked at, like, which websites have you looked at? Like, where have you gone for information to support your decision? And like I mentioned before, they have tons of conversations with whomever in the industry may be using the platform already. And sometimes they find those people through their current network or through reading reviews. I think a lot of the review sites are really key for B2B SaaS, and you just need reviews because that's what's so important when buyers are going to buy something, and particularly when it's a high-risk purchase. I think there is a rather high level of distrust, and it's not getting better around marketing content. And so when you produce marketing content, it needs to be honest. And I was going to say relatively honest, but that's not really what I believe. I think it should be very honest. It's a fight. Like, I've had that fight so many times with founders I've worked with. But like, every opportunity you have in content is to build trust, not to erode trust. And so when there's things that happen in the buying process, like that, you know, you mentioned something before, like you go to click on the pricing tab on the website and it actually is a contact us form. It's not pricing. It's like a bait and switch. Or you go to say, you know, I'm going to go talk to sales, click that. And then you actually get an SDR and it's like another bait and switch. And so if you download a piece of content and it's telling you it's going to give you something and it gives you something else, like it's another bait and switch. And so the more of those things happen, it's like you signing up for the free trial, getting nothing. Instead, like you get chased. All of those things erode our trust. And that's exactly the opposite of what we want to do with content and marketing.
I have started like 25 years ago, and I started originally in marketing as well. So I know a little bit about it, probably not as much as you do, but you know, I have the feeling that in general, and that's a generalization now, marketing wants to polish as much as they can all these little edges off of the business, off of the solution, to make it as clean and polished as possible. But sometimes these little bumps is what makes the difference. And it's very rare that you come across someone who says, we have a CRM system, but this, you know, these embracing the flaws, because no business is perfect. No solution is perfect. No sales is perfect. Nothing is ever perfect, but it appears to be marketing wants to, in general, just give the impression that everything is, you know, hoochie-coochie and fine and lovely-jubbly and everything. But in fact, you know, once you are onboarded, then you say, okay, that you didn't say that. You didn't mention this or that.
Right.
How do you go about when you work with a customer, with one of your clients, to say, you said relatively honest, and then you switched to, no, we have to be honest. Yeah. Because nobody likes bullshitting. Let's eradicate relatively out of our vocabulary and just be brutally honest. Maybe. How do you go about working with a client and bringing in that attitude, bringing in that mindset?
Yeah. There's a few things. So, I mean, I'm going to talk about them in different touch points that a buyer might have. So the first one is in your website messaging. And like website messaging, as you know, for being a business owner and probably working with lots of clients, like is a hotly contested piece of marketing. Everyone wants to have a piece of it, like, and an opinion, like including like the head of IT to like, you know, head of HR. Just it's a disaster. But one way that I have found to be a great way to kind of leave some of those bumps and edges that you were talking about in your marketing to give more of a feeling of authenticity and reality is to use a lot of buyer language in your website content. And the research I do is often like a huge goldmine of that type of language, because I get people talking about, you know, their challenges and the different parts of the sales cycle that were tricky for them and like all these different, you know, really key pieces of information, like how they describe the benefits of your product, even like that from the mouths of customers can be really powerful on your website. Because if a few people have said that in the same way, then you get like, you know, a clue of like, oh, this is how we should maybe be using it. This is how we should be talking about it. And often it's very different about how you're talking about the benefits internally. That has happened over and over again, even for my own, you know, like consultancy, how my buyers you know, tell me that my work has changed their business is so different than what I thought, you know, it would sound like. So website copy is huge. I think another part is case studies. Case studies are really important for B2B SaaS, particularly, you know, when you're selling to an audience to whom business impact is critical to them making an investment. And so when you can include quantitative results in case studies that very clearly show, you know, we moved it from here to here, or like we increased this from this to this, or this, you know, change from this to this, that gives you a realistic idea of what kind of results you might get rather than just making sweeping marketing statements without anything to back them up.
I've seen a lot of times marketing not having a conversation with a prospect, not once. So they actually are just being reliant on sales, hopefully at least sales, to tell them who's the buyer and what do they think. But you know, it's so important to just pick up the phone and talk to at least existing customers and say, what was the challenge that we solved? And just get that out of the horse's mouth instead of just thinking, what did I learn at university about marketing or what is the new buzzword?
Exactly. There's one tiny thing that I want to add to what you just said, like around using customer language. I think like, and even embedding it in the practice of marketing, like that marketing would be talking to buyers on a regular basis. I think one thing to remember is that be sure that you're talking to buyers who are actually within your ideal customer profile, because that is going to give you a nuance on the language that helps you to describe the benefits of your software, which may be same to other benefits, but in a way that is specifically resonating with your ideal customer. I think that's really important because they like, you know, if I'm selling to, you know, I don't know, say a big marketing agency versus a small marketing agency, the big marketing agency might talk about the benefit in a different way than the small marketing agency. And if I'm trying to get more of the big ones, then I need to pay attention to the language they're using.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that is one way how you can put in place a powerful prospecting strategy. Usually what we see is like the old school prospecting is just go out there, push, maybe even pitch, and then just try your best. What we love to do is just to grab one or two SDRs, place them into marketing, and then say, okay, we're going to do an outreach, an outbound campaign, but completely different than what you've learned, what you've seen, what you've ever done. And some things that we do is to just get on LinkedIn, connect with the ICP, with decision makers, and just ask the question. Listen, we have a podcast. Maybe we do, maybe we don't. Maybe it's for the blog, whoever. But we're doing some market research. What's your biggest challenge in relation to the solution that we that we provide? Yeah. So what does that do? Number one, it gives us an impression of what's going on in the market, what's going on the ICP side, but also, of course, it positions us as the vendor right in front of the right people. And yeah, we're pitchy, we're not salesy, we don't want anything from them apart from what keeps you up at night.
It's data collection.
And,
yeah.
And that is, yeah, it's kind of a sneaky way around, but that's what makes a brand stand out as well. If you do things differently than everybody else, that's what keeps you in the mind of the buyers. With okay, that what exactly is it that you do, and how, why are you asking me that question, and what do you do to solve this? Yeah. So that is a sneaky way to get in there with value and providing value to the vendor side, to marketing and sales, to get a better insight into what is going on at the moment.
Yeah.
Repurpose it as content. So don't just use it as a Trojan horse, but really use it. So marketing can use it for ebooks, for reports, for and so on and so on. Sales gets an understanding of what are the questions that we should be using then
in language,
calls in the meetings. Yeah. Which topics should we need to raise if they don't raise it, if the buyers don't raise it? Mm-hmm. But also, again, it's a neat way of prospecting, because all of a sudden you're on the top of a decision maker, and you don't want to sell. You're not selling it up. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious. So we have this podcast and blah 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 blah. So that's one way that we found it's kind of a neat way around that typical prospecting and getting you the insights that you know, because I really love what you said. Just be very specific with the ICP and just talk to the ICP.
Yeah.
And yeah. Small companies, small marketing agency, different challenges than bigger ones.
Yeah.
So I really love that you point that out. Yeah. Going back a little bit, you said the buyers hate going through a process of comparing old tech stack to a potential new platform. We discussed about that with the CFO. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you, because you said, please do not do a feature comparison with your competitor. Question, why not? And what should we do instead?
Yeah. So I think that one of the most overwhelming parts of making a buying decision, from what I've heard from SaaS buyers, is this whole business of comparing features. And I don't know if it's a function of the fact that we have very low attention spans, or the fact that like none of us really are in a place where we're able to process lists of features that are all named different things, but maybe doing kind of the same thing. It's really hard for us to compare like, you know, two lists of features versus like three or four or five. And so buyers often tell me that like that feature comparison part of the sales cycle is just like so annoying, so frustrating, so hard to feel like they're informed enough about each of the features and what they do for each of the vendors to make an accurate comparison. And so depending on the type of buyer you have, I've heard some buyers, they just give up. They're like, we just gave up and we went with our gut. And so, okay, that's one option. But I'd like to think that there's a better, more intelligent way of making this decision that is, you know, using less cognitive load. And so one of the ways is to make sure they're very, very clear on how your solution, not any of the competitors, no one else, but how your solution is going to replace what they're currently using. And this is an important step, because like this is really, you know, the picture of where we are today to where we're going. And it could be a combination of a tech stack that they're using right now, and your solution may cover like three out of four of the solutions that you're currently, you know, cobbled together. But that last part, what are you going to do to fill in that gap? And so when sales, and I think it's important that this is a combination of sales and marketing, but particularly sales, I think when they can have, you know, a well-informed idea of which solutions their prospective buyers are typically coming from, like what are the most common things, whether, you know, like you said earlier, whether it's like a combination of spreadsheets and, you know, QuickBooks and, you know, a first generation version of what you do, or whether it's, you know, a full solution that covers all those things, helped sales to understand what are the common, you know, scenarios people are coming from, and what are our best recommendations to help them use our solution to cover off all those things. And just make it really clear, like what features will be covered, what features won't be covered. Because if they realize that, you know, accounting and finance part of whatever your solution is no longer going to be covered, like, do they still need to keep that subscription they had before? Can they downgrade it? Do they need to upgrade it? Like all those like niggly questions that like no one really ever wants to deal with, but your buyer has to deal with them. And so as a salesperson, like if you could be empathetic to that and inform yourself to have those conversations in a like, in a consultative way, I think that is a huge amount of value you can add.
Yeah.
So that's one thing you can do.
That goes way beyond the typical, let's say, sales script or typical sales questions. So you as a salesperson, I know, you know, I've been doing that for 25 years now. And that is one thing that I'm absolutely bullish on, is for sales to understand the purchasing procedure internally on the buy side. Yeah. Who is involved? Why? What's on their agenda? What happens if we come in with our solution and all of a sudden, maybe, you know, accounting doesn't need that other subscription?
Sorry. And that creates a whole lot of other internal problems that if you don't help them deal with them.
Yeah. Like, how can you cancel that? How long is that going to be in? Okay. So that goes into the cost factors as well. So you have half a year that you need to pay other software.
Yep. Exactly.
Maybe we can do something in terms of, you know, helping you deal with that. But this understanding of what it really means and the impact of getting our solution in. It's not just plug and play and here we go and everybody's happy, clappy. It rarely, rarely, if you go into enterprise, there's a lot of people are impacted by that. And so I really love that you point that out, that if sales knows about this and has that consciousness, and also the attitude to raise these points, to bring them up in forms of
proactively, yeah,
in the form of questions. How do you go about that? So if we do this, I assume this would happen on your side. So what happens then? How would the CFO feel about it if they would lose some subscriptions that they need in their everyday business?
Mm.
How open are your people to change their workflows?
Yeah, I love this.
There will be, these things that can facilitate a purchase decision.
Yeah.
That makes you stand out as a sales organization, as a sales person on the vendor side. That's what makes you stand out.
Totally. Yeah.
From all the other competitors who are just, you know, trying to sell.
Yep. Yeah. There's a mindset that I think is really important to embed in sales and marketing. And it's that, like, in B2B, like, we are selling change. And I'm not the first person to say this, but it, once that clicks in your mind, you're like, okay, we're selling change. It's not just a matter of, like you say, plug and play, but like when this new technology comes in, it's going to change processes. It's going to change the way data is collected and distributed within the organization. It's going to change the way people do their day-to-day job, and people don't like change. And so buyer enablement for me is really like a big piece of it is helping companies navigate that change. And it's through the content you create, but also the conversations you have like on the sales side.
Absolutely. And I absolutely love that, because the way that you go about buyer enablement has a lot to do with sales. And I really love that, because I think we both are on the same page that sales and marketing needs to be like one front, and not like tension, not like friction, but just like one department. And I think from my experience, what keeps them apart is just different KPIs, different strategy, different management. Yeah. A good way to go about it is to have a head of sales and marketing, to have at least someone being responsible for both. That's a good way of doing it. If you have it separated, the transformation and the change will take more time and more effort.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, but, no, I think, continue.
No.
I'm just going to say, I think like the CROs that I've had the chance to work with, who do have that perspective of overseeing sales and marketing, I think it is always going to bring the best results. Like, I can't say that all of them operate in a model that I think is, you know, ideal. Like, I would say get rid of the MQL. And, you know, there are CROs who are forward thinking in that respect. Actually, there's some great ones in Canada that I'm thinking of that I've, you know, crossed paths with in the past. And they take that leap and it changes a lot of things. But I think that's sort of the wall that has to come down. It's like when marketing is no longer solely focused on throwing leads over the wall to sales and then just like wiping their hands of it and being done with it, that is when you actually start to see real change. Because otherwise, marketing's sphere of influence or their sphere of responsibility feels very small. It's just, oh, we just need to get some email addresses. And I'm not saying that that's easy. Like, I'm not minimizing the challenge of that, but it's not revenue focused or retention focused. And those are things that I think marketing actually really does need to care about.
Yeah. And I think from the management and leadership side, marketing needs to be measured against revenue, because everything else is just, that's how you create a wall between sales and marketing. When you have MQLs, when you have just this, you know, website traffic or whatever the vanity KPI of the day it is right now for marketing, well, start measuring marketing activity against revenue. And then we'll get rid of all this time wasted on the sales side to sift through all of these MQLs who were just trying to get some information but are not there yet. And maybe would have disqualified themselves if they had ungated information.
That's right.
Okay, it sent me the price list. Vroom.
Yep.
We book a call with you. I just wanted to, what is it? What's the price? Well, it starts at, I don't know, 95 per month. We're a startup. We don't have money. Mm-hmm. Well, good day to you, sir. Yeah. You know, and I'm going back to one thing that really stood out when you told the stories is buyer indecision. There are all of a sudden so overwhelmed that they don't make a decision at all, or they kind of postpone the decision, or they think, well, that is getting completely out of hand or too complicated for now. I've got 10 other projects on my desk. Let's just postpone next quarter, you know?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
That's next quarter. Really, we do it next quarter. Manana, yeah. Manana. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And it's kind of sad because when you do have a buyer, you know, and you know they have the fire engine red need and they're just drowning in inefficiency for whatever reason, like if you can make that buying experience easier for them, that is the way you're going to make the sale sooner rather than later. And like, ideally, that's the way that you differentiate your brand. And I just think buying ease is such an undervalued like thing within the buying cycle. Like we know, like you mentioned earlier, we know that from buying from Amazon. Like if you can get something easier from Amazon, you will get it from Amazon. And it's so like, we can't say that the B2B buying cycle, which can last to like 18 to 24 months, is going to be easy. It's never going to be easy, but it's going to be better than the long, hard slog that it is now.
I put out a poll on LinkedIn a couple of weeks ago, and that's the result was clear that sales cycles are getting longer and longer. So, okay, what do we do about that? And I think that is part of, as you said, it can be up to 12, 24 months or even longer, depends on what the solution or what the product is and so on. But we found that a lot has to do with buyer enablement being facilitated by sales. Because if sales changes the way they go about sales conversations, helping the buyer making sense of everything that they need to see in terms of information, once we have sales organizations, sales teams do that, all of a sudden the sales cycle reduces because we help the buyer buy from us or our customer in that case, because we enable sales to enable the buyer.
It seems very logical, doesn't it?
Like seems. Yeah. Again, it's habits, creatures of habits. And especially when you're in organizations, the fear of change is always there. What if we don't close any contracts with this? Or what if we lose customers? What if we don't generate enough leads next quarter? Well, what if you do generate a lot of leads, but they're all completely unqualified?
Yeah. Yeah.
Totally. What's your KPI? Is that the goal? Is that the objective, to just keep sales busy, to just keep marketing busy? You know, it should be the other way around. I would be happy for anyone to have fewer conversations with the right person who have qualified themselves, disqualified other vendors, and are now ready to have a conversation and are being directed to someone who is knowledgeable about the product, about the market, about the buyer, about the situation, economically, features, benefits, implementation, and so forth. And one thing that you pointed out as well is the fear of the process and the implementation that can paralyze a buyer, that can break a deal, even when you're, I don't know, 6 months into the deal already, and then all of a sudden, you know, drip feed the buyer with things that come up in the implementation process instead of just being absolutely transparent and upfront with it. How do you go about that with your customers? How do you implement mechanisms to eliminate this fear, this paralyzing fear of making no decision, or the fear of changing systems?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think, I mean, particularly the fear on the implementation, like I can't even emphasize how big and scary this is for some buyers. Like, and it's often a lot earlier in the buying decision than you would guess, because I think our assumption sometimes as vendors is like, oh, well, you know, we'll go through the sale and like the AE will, you know, ink the contract. And then at the end, we'll hand them off to the CSM and they'll deal with the implementation stuff. We won't worry about it until then. But really for buyers, they're thinking about it way before the contract gets signed. And there's lots of different ways of dealing with this. Like, I think if a company has a robust set of training videos and implementation content, that can help a lot. But typically it's buried in some other place that you get to once you become a customer. And so what I've recommended to some of my clients is not even, it's not creating new content, it's repurposing their current, some of their, you know, pieces of implementation content just to put that in the hands of the buyers long before they get to inking the contract, but so they can start to visualize what that implementation is going to look like. And, you know, I've worked with a bunch of different companies, like some really disorganized little SaaS startups, and, you know, you got to love them, but like there will be times, and I remember talking to their buyers where the buyers told me that they felt like the project management type documents they got from the vendor were actually like not really that helpful because they weren't organized in a way that showed that they knew how to manage projects. And so the buyer themselves, in this case, they were event planners and they are super organized, super like project management focused people. And so it kind of comes back to like understanding what your buyer needs out of you at this stage of, you know, transition and change, and like anticipating like, okay, these are really organized people. It's a bit about the psychographics. Like if in this case, they were particularly organized people and it was, you know, crazy that they were getting implementation content that wasn't organized against, you know, timelines and dates. And this is what we need from you. And this is what you need from us. Because yeah, it just gave them all this, like these feelings of like fear. And so yeah, regardless of psychographics, I would say you need to be organized about the implementation and transmit that to the buyer as early as you can in the sales cycle. And even more specifically to that, like if you've done, you know, research with your buyers and you understand that this is a hurdle for them, or there's a particular part of it that's a hurdle. Like I spoke earlier to the accounting and finance transition. That was a hurdle for like, you know, 9 out of 15 buyers that I spoke to, or maybe more than that. Like, so you know that that's something you need to deal with. Because otherwise, it's just going to continue being a problem that slows down the sales cycle.
What I just thought was, well, if I want to know more about a solution, I just go to YouTube. Mm-hmm. And I just Google it. Is it Google? I Google YouTube. I don't know. So anything that I can get my hands on in terms of throughs and how to use when and blah blah blah. And I know sometimes it's not coming from the vendor, it's coming from users, from other YouTube users that have used it. And although that is helpful, I think what I really like what you said is just have a hub, a content hub, and provide them with everything that they need in terms of how is it structured, what do we do, how do we go about it. Because as you said, the contract, signing of the contract is the last piece of the puzzle. You can't just overwhelm them with implementation and process after they sign. It has to come before that, because that is part of the decision-making process. Is the process as convenient as we would like it to be, or at least can we deal with it in a way that we get the best ROI out of it? And I, coming from a content point of view, these content, if you put it out on YouTube or you put it out on your website, that's probably the videos with the least amount of views, because not everybody is interested in that. It's just a few people who are interested in learning more about the implementation process. So from an ROI perspective of the content or the KPIs, I should rather say, the KPIs would be absolutely low, but the impact on the ROI is absolutely tremendous, because it's like you tell the client, this is how we are going about it. This is what we do. This is what we need you to do. And then we bring everything together. And maybe it's just get, I don't know, 10 views per month. But that's from it. Those people who need to watch it to make a decision to sign or sign not the contract.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would say like that this is connected to the whole strategy of helping leads disqualify themselves early in the process. Like what happens, obviously, to your marketing funnel when that's the case is that you end up with less leads. Every lead is more qualified. Whoever gets to that point of inking the contract, it's like a handful of people at that point. But that's why it's kind of a bit like I'm on the fence about, you know, a content measurement has like blown wide open and you can measure every single thing. But when you have a buyer enablement strategy and you are actively trying to limit the amount of buyers that come to you, because that's what you're doing, but making every interaction super, super relevant and important, your content KPIs will look totally different than they did when you just had like an inflated funnel, but your results on the sales side will also look different. And so it comes back to what we were saying about, like, you know, marketing KPIs, and they're sometimes fluffy, and they are, because you're getting so much website traffic from all these different people who probably will never buy from you. And to me, that is a bit of a waste of time. Yeah.
Yeah. That reminds me of one thing that I did last month. I asked a couple of salespeople, what is more important to you in Q3? Is it to qualify fast or disqualify faster? Mm-hmm. And the majority said disqualify faster, which I understand, because, you know, you need to get through the no's quicker to get to the yeses. Yeah. Fair enough. And I think when we take that out of the scope of work or the responsibility of sales and put that into marketing, that adds tremendous value to the sales targets and the productivity of sales as an organization, because you have to disqualify fast. Not everybody is a good fit, but if you put it at the beginning of the journey, before this, before the lead is even touching down on sales, that makes it even better and more efficient for sales to then have the exact conversations that they need to have to increase the closing rate, because it's pre-qualified already. And that's, I really like how you laid that out, and just made me think of that little campaign that I did, and just, you know, ask what is important to you.
For sure.
And it's absolutely, I think, crucial to recognize that there are so many things happening in a sales organization that could be easily solved by marketing.
Yep. All the scalable.
But sales is just sitting on it like a hen on an egg. Mm-hmm. It's just, no, we do it. We've done it for 30 years now, like this, and we continue doing that. But with the technology of marketing tech, content tech, websites, videos, and so forth, you have a whole plethora of screws or angles to buyer enablement that helps sales on the other side of the scale. Mm-hmm. And it helps both sides. It helps the business.
Totally. Marketing is more
efficient. Sales is more efficient. Yeah. And we can close more contracts.
Yeah. And the buyers are happier, because as much as they can self-educate on your site, like, the better their experience will be. Because, like, we know that, you know, buyers come to sales, I forget what it is that Gartner said a while ago, 58% through the sales cycle, something like that. You can correct me. But is it 58?
I think it's later. I think it's
later. 68?
I think it's 85.
Really? Okay.
Very late. Very late.
Okay.
Very late.
So, like, what are they doing with all that time? Well, they're doing research, and they're trying to get as much information as they can to get as close to a decision as they can before they bother talking to sales. And, like, the more you can help them self-educate, the better.
But you know what? I think part of that number is the bad experience that buyers have or had with sales.
Totally.
Because they just avoid it like it's the plague to talk to sales.
Yeah.
Just give me everything that I need. If you're a good fit for me, I'll get in touch with you.
I'll come to you.
I'll promise you, I'll do it. Yeah. I want your solution. But I think it's the fear of being put into useless discovery calls and qualification that just serves the vendor side. So I think that is part of the attitude, or that added to that attitude of, please, sales, no.
Who likes being sold to? Like, that's why we need to change.
Everybody loves to buy.
Yeah,
you have to buy, but don't tell me anything.
Yeah, that's
the beauty of it.
It's also the gentle nuance that, like, it's a lot for us to learn as sales and marketers.
Yeah. We just got to, let's say, unlearn a couple of things, relearn other things, and then just learn something new, and that is the whole magic behind it. Because we're all buyers. We don't like to, you know, I've seen sales managers leading a team of SDRs doing cold calls every day. The sales managers don't pick up cold calls.
This is the thing.
Like, okay.
Yeah.
Are you listening to yourself?
Yes.
What is going on there? Totally. We've got some major problems to unveil here. Let's go to a therapy session or something like that. Because it's just human. It's human nature. It's human nature. We go out as a buyer. We just look for the best solution. Might be a service provider, as you are. Might be a SaaS tool. Might be anything. but we want to, you know, we're independent, we're empowered. Just give me everything that I need to make a decision. Yeah. And with the whole homogenous landscape of solutions out there, sometimes it's just not that easy because you're overwhelmed by options. And that is something that I think you mentioned as well, like the tiered pricing options on the website. Mm-hmm. I think psychologically not more than three, if I remember correctly.
That's right. Yeah.
Three tiered pricing that makes it easier for, and there are other some psychological hacks that you can add.
There are. Pricing is a hack for conversation. Yeah.
It is. Oh, actually we should do that. I love thinking about pricing. Yeah. Sarah, thank you so much for taking the time to come on this podcast. I made tons of notes. It's absolutely eye-opening how marketing can really support sales and vice versa if we start breaking down the walls and just sit at a round table and just say, okay, what can we do together? And I really appreciate all your insights, all the hacks that you gave us today. As I said, I made a ton of notes and my marketing team won't be happy on Monday, but here we are. here we go. Is there anything that I did not ask you, but you would have loved being asked?
I ask that question to my buyers when I do choose. It's such a good one. I think we've covered everything. You know what? One thing we didn't cover, and this is maybe a different discussion for next time, but how do we change KPIs for sales and marketing so they're actually looking at pipeline acceleration? And I'm curious to know if you have this conversation with your buyers, because I've had it with mine, but the length of my projects is like a research and strategy length. And so I don't typically stay with them for like months and months after. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
It's a really, really great question. And we're in a position where we say we only, if we can't be with you for at least 3 months, go to someone else. That we're not the right fit for you. So on average, it's 6 months that we're really going to work closely together with everyone, the C-level, management, leadership, and the sales team and the individuals, and also marketing. So what we do is you have to kind of drip feed it a little bit psychologically. So what we do is we identify in the sales team, we identify those individuals who are the most open-minded to change. And then we put them in a separate team. And can be one, can be two, can be three. It really depends on the size. And then we take the same approach with marketing and see that we can get them on the table as well. And then we have a pilot that we run, like a proof of concept internally. Okay. And we say, okay, here's what we do. This is sales and marketing working as one unit. We do prospecting, we do outbound, we do inbound, we do all of that, but we do it radically different from anything that you've seen so far, mm-hmm. especially on the sales side. Mm-hmm. And then once we have that proof of concept, and that is for customers who are open to change, but you can feel there's a resistance. So we don't want to overwhelm management. We don't want to overwhelm leadership. We know that they're open to change, but they're a bit hesitant to make the big shift. You know, so what happens if it doesn't work like we anticipated and we lose the revenue? So we take them by the hand and say, absolutely fine. You know, you told us you're committed to change. So here's how we do it. We do it step by step and then we roll it out. And then this little isolated, quote unquote, isolated team gets bigger and bigger because we roll the strategy then out across sales and marketing. And then whatever department is needed in there as well, might be a financial department to, you know, for the payment and stuff like that. But that's typically how we do it. If there's resistance, if it's a smaller company, they're more open-minded, we do a more intense kickoff meeting to get everything in place before we start. Mm-hmm. But usually that step-by-step approach worked really, really well because then we can report back on a regular basis the progress that we're making. And that little isolated team then has completely different KPIs because we detach them from the traditional KPIs or from the existing KPIs that are there. So we might take one or two that are already there, but we also bring in other KPIs that are more focused on what we do on the strategy side. And the strategy is always, you know, the company strategy will be considered, and then we plug in our strategy for sales and marketing as well. So that's it's a smooth transition. That's why we need to work together with them, not only on a one-off event. That doesn't work. I hate these one-off sales trainings. That doesn't give any value. And that's also the reason why I said, okay, I want to have fewer conversations.
Yep.
But with those people, or with those businesses, I should rather say, who are open and committed to change, just don't know how exactly. Well, that's what we do. That's what we show you.
That's super interesting. Thanks for explaining that.
Well, thanks for the question. But that's definitely, I think that's, we can do another podcast around that, because the KPIs is, you have to measure that. You have to measure success. And especially if you're bringing in change, which you do every single time. So how do we, can we use the KPIs that we already have? Well, let's talk about that. Okay. Yeah. So we do things differently, but we measure with the old KPIs. Yeah. Okay. Let's sleep over that. So, but then we can have another conversation about that, because that's
the
topic as well. It's more on the strategy side.
Yeah.
Things and more on the management side of things. Yeah. I'd love to do that.
Sure. Yeah. That'd be awesome.
Perfect. So thank you so much. If you want to learn more about what Sarah does, go to buyerenablementcontent.com. That's one word, buyerenablementcontent.com. We put that in the description below. We put all your contact details below for all the inbound leads that you will be getting from this podcast. Of course, they have to pre-qualify themselves on fireenablementcontent.com.
Of course they do.
Sarah, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for
taking the time and opening up your treasure chest of fire enablement content. Thank you.
No problem. It was a great chat. Thanks a lot, Joseph.